I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Gershom Sizomu, the chief rabbi of Uganda and the leader of the Abu Yudaya people, and the first sub-Saharan African to be ordained a rabbi at an American seminary. We'll also have a visit from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Oshrat Borel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This past week marked the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which has been on the top of the news and on the cover of seemingly every magazine, and the 150th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, which has received much less publicity. And this coming week, we begin reading the great story of Joseph in the Torah and begin to celebrate Hanukkah and hold the festival of Thanksgiving. Frankly, there are just too many good things to talk about today, but in a rather beautiful and meaningful way, they all connect. And they are all about exploring unlimited potential, or really, seeking to fulfill your dreams in a pragmatic way. I'll explain. When the newly inaugurated young, handsome president, John F. Kennedy, told his energetic country, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country," he was unlocking the almost unlimited potential of a free, bold, and confident nation. His stirring vision, the words were in part those of his great speechwriter, Ted Sorensen, was articulated in a way that struck a mystic chord, as Lincoln would have termed it. "The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it, and the glow from that fire can truly light the world. My fellow citizens of the world," Kennedy said, "ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man." And JFK symbolically represented the hope of that then young generation that had survived the Depression and won World War II. He unleashed the power of unlimited opportunity by portraying the American dream of freedom in new and stirring ways, as a model of service, as an attempt to fulfill great ideals. We would fly to and land on the moon. We would conquer poverty and ignorance. We would end oppression and prejudice. It was a great and wonderful dream. That it did not fully succeed, that Kennedy was assassinated less than 3 years into his visionary presidency, that while we did land on the moon just 8 years later, the other idealistic goals proved harder to accomplish. But that did not vitiate the power of that dream. For it was Kennedy's close association with pragmatic idealism, the high goals of the serious plans and work needed to reach them, that made his presidency, in the minds of many Americans, a new Camelot. He articulated the greatest dreams of his generation, and he and many others sought to accomplish them. In a way, his words and his ideas echoed those of his predecessor a century before. When Abraham Lincoln, in the midst of a brutal civil war, affirmed, "This nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth," Lincoln set the stage for those later words and efforts to establish freedom and equality under the law for everyone. Lincoln understood as well as anyone that dreams could not be accomplished without hard, practical work. But he also understood that we need those dreams, and that they help us sustain that work until we can achieve them. When Lincoln made Thanksgiving a truly national holiday, he was affirming a dream of a people with the freedom to enjoy bounty in a climate of freedom. We will celebrate that this week, too, at Thanksgiving. But this story and the connections on this particular Sunday morning go back much deeper into history. As we approach the festival of Hanukkah, which commemorates the victory of the Jews over their Syrian Greek overlords who wished to destroy religious and political freedom, We remember another time when practical dreaming overcame huge obstacles. 2,000 years before Lincoln, 2,100 years before JFK, a small group of dreamers insisted that their religious freedom mattered more to them than life itself, and that they would fight and struggle and work to overcome seemingly impossible odds to claim it. And their victory, not easily, but over years of fighting and working and, yes, dreaming, meant that today we can celebrate that freedom by praying and living as we wish. Without the events that Hanukkah commemorates, there would be no Judaism today, nor any Christianity or Islam either, for that matter. The Maccabees dreamed of freedom and fought to achieve it, ultimately, for all of us. And first and finally, in this week's Torah portion, and last week's for that matter, dreams play a central role. Our biblical ancestor Joseph dreamed of personal greatness, but through tribulations he learned that dreams are only achieved by work and struggle. And so he came to interpret others' dreams, and eventually to act on them in pragmatic ways. His actions eventually reunified his family and brought him back together with his father and brothers, a personal dream that became the genesis of our entire people. To me, Judaism is pragmatic idealism, practical dreaming. As Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism, said, "Im tirtzu ein zo agada," if you will it, it is no dream. But of course, if there is no dream in the first place, then nothing changes, and we never improve the world. Less than 3 months before Kennedy was shot, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous "I Have a Dream" speech echoed that theme. His dream has mostly become true, or at least it's much closer to fulfillment than it was in King's or Kennedy's time. But for us, the reality is that we need to remember to dream, and then to work to achieve those dreams. For when we do that, we can fulfill all the unlimited potential that God has implanted within us. To play us in on that theme this morning, here's a pre-Hanukkah preview of music for the Festival of the Lights coming up fast this Wednesday night for 8 nights. It's by contemporary composer Michael Isaacson, his Light the Legend. That was Mike Isaacson's Light the Legend for the coming holiday of lights and latkes starting this Wednesday night, the night before Thanksgiving, November 27th, for 8 nights of dreaming. There are many Jewish communities around the world. Each is distinctive in its own way, but you are about to learn about one that is truly unique, a sub-Saharan African Jewish community in Uganda that is thriving in perhaps the most unlikely place for Judaism ever. Learn about the fascinating Abu Yudaya community from their chief rabbi, Gershom Suzumu, a U.S.-educated conservative rabbi, when we return here on To Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. To play in our guest this morning, here's a song from the Abu Yudaya, the Jews of Uganda. It's their setting of Hine Matov, how good it is and how pleasant for us to be together in unity.
Laba we kulyo kulungi we kusanyusa Abo Luganda okutula Laba we kulyo kulungi we kusanyusa Abo Luganda okutula Hine matovu umanaimu Cheveti ahim Yahadu inematovu umanaimu Cheveti ahim gam yahadu Lava we kulyo kulungi we kusanyusa Abo Luganda okutula Lava we kulyo kulungi we kusanyusa Abo Luganda okutula Hine matovu umanaimu Cheveti ahim gam yahadu Hine matovu umanaimu Cheveti ahim gam yahadu.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish this morning a special guest, Rabbi Gershom Sizomu. He's the chief rabbi of Uganda and part of the Abu Yudaya, a remarkable group of Jews that I think many people don't know very much about. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning and thank you for having me.
Tell us about the history of your Jewish community.
It is a community of native Ugandans who chose Judaism in 1919 after the founder of the community, the late Semei Kakunguru, read a Christian Bible and instead discovered Judaism. So he ripped the Bible into two and gave back the New Testament to the Christians and retained the Old Testament, which became a guide for his Jewish practice and faith.
The Jewish community of Uganda, at the time it was a British colony, it has maintained its Jewish identity through a very complicated century, almost 100 years now.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about how they managed to maintain their integrity.
It was very difficult because being a small and minority community in a country that is predominantly Christian and Muslim, there were many challenges. But the more challenges they faced, the more strong they became. So the community has tried very much to marry within, and over the past few years, we have our own school system, and school systems were used by Christian missionaries to convert people to Christianity.
Of course.
And the community actually in the past did not participate in education for fear of converting to Christianity.
Being converted to Christianity.
Exactly.
Right.
So now, over time, there were illiterate people, there were no people who went to school, until recently that we established our own education system.
But it's fascinating to have a Jewish community that wasn't based in literacy, because,
yes,
we're the people of the book.
Exactly.
The Torah is at the heart of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Were there rabbis that knew and then they just taught verbally?
Actually, they knew from those who learned from early Christian missionaries. learned how to read and write Luganda, which is our local language. And so the Bible was translated into Luganda. And all they did was to read and make their own interpretations. So of
their own Midrashim, really.
Exactly, their own Midrashim.
Well, then we'll talk about your personal story and the journey of the Abu Yudaya in the 21st century when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is the cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes. Propylene glycol, vegetable glycerine, flavorings from Flavor Art in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kfel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming them from there, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Continuing our pre-Hanukkah preview of music for the brilliant holiday of candles and presents, here's the ridiculous but somehow now classic Adam Sandler, the Hanukkah song, Eight Crazy Nights.
Put on your yarmulke, here comes Hanukkah. So much Hanukkah to celebrate Hanukkah. Hanukkah is the festival of light. Instead of one day of presents, we have eight crazy nights. When you feel like the only kid in town without a Christmas tree, here's a list of people who are Jewish, just like you and me. David Lee Roth lights the menorah. So do James Caan, Kirk Douglas, and the late Dinah Shore. Guess who eats together at the Carnegie Deli? Bowser from Shanana and Arthur Fonzarelli. Paul Newman's half Jewish, Goldie Hawn's half too. Put them together. What a fine looking Jew. You don't need Deck the Halls or Jingle Bell Rock, 'cause you can spin a dreidel with Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock, both Jewish. Put on your yarmulke, it's time for Hanukkah. The owner of the Seattle Supersonicas celebrates Hanukkah. O.J. Simpson, not a Jew. But guess who is? Hall of Famer Rod Carew. He converted.
We got Ann Landers and her sister, dear Abby. Harrison Ford's a quarter Jewish, not too shabby. Some people think that Ebenezer Scrooge is. Well, he's not, but guess who is? All Three Stooges. So many Jews are in showbiz. Tom Cruise isn't, but I heard his agent is. Tell your friend Veronica, it's time to celebrate Hanukkah. Oh, bar, get a harmonica on this lovely, lovely Hanukkah. So drink your gin and tonica. Have a happy, 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 happy Hanukkah. Happy Hanukkah.
That was Adam Sandler's The Hanukkah Song for Hanukkah, beginning this Wednesday night for eight, yeah, crazy nights. And now in our ongoing Two Jewish effort to include the absolute best of everything Jewish, including culture, plus a decent-sized helping of shtick, here's our top 10 list of the best Beatles Hanukkah songs. Number 10, She Loves Jews, Yeah, Yeah, Yeah. Number 9, I Get By With Little Gelt From My Friends. Number 8, I Wanna Hold Your Dreidel. Number 7, All You Need Is Gelt. Number 6, 8 Nights This Week. Number 5, She's Got Some Presents to Hide. Number 4, I'm Just a Jealous Goy. Number 3, While My Candles Gently Drip. Number 2, Hey Jews. And of course, the number one top best Beatles Hanukkah song is We're Salt-N-Pepa's Lonely Latke Band. That was the top 10 list of the best Beatles Hanukkah songs for Hanukkah beginning this Wednesday night. We welcome Ramivi Na'an Israel, Oshrot Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrot.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And an early Chag Hanukkah Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
We were talking last week about the kibbutz. You lived, the whole kibbutz movement, you lived on a kibbutz right up on the border, the Jordan border, Hamadiyah. Tell us, you know, and you mentioned last week that at first there was great hopes, it was very successful, and then gradually it slipped, and then it fell into bankruptcy in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about your experience of the kibbutz and what you thought went right, what went wrong, and how that exemplifies the kibbutz movement today.
Actually, we joined the kibbutz. You remember that I born in Beit Shean. So
yes,
we joined the kibbutz only like after the bankruptcy.
Ah.
We find out that there is an opportunity for us like to grow in terms of community, because you know we didn't grow in a kibbutz. We are, it's not our beliefs. Like, but anyway,
I should mention a kibbutz. Sometimes children are raised communally.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, everybody takes care of everybody else's kids. You don't have the same connections of nuclear family you sometimes have.
So, but when we joined Hamadiyah, there was no joint dining room or like any other service. Wasn't like we didn't use any other. No one has a services, like a communal services. It was a very nice neighborhood to live in. Some of them call them a neighborhood of Beit Shean because it really was a neighborhood. But it was, we liked the community life. Like we celebrated together like Shavuot and some other Jewish holidays. But and we had like all kind of committees like here in Tucson, you know.
Committees.
Education, culture, and so on. But this was the only communal things that we had in the kibbutz. No, salaries was, you know, the kibbutz no longer share salaries.
You didn't share your income with
incomes
everybody else,
or
right?
Yeah, everyone works for his own, and there is actually no much left from the ideology of kibbutz that was an utopic idea at the beginning, like in the early century, early 19th.
Early 20th century, early 1900s.
20.
You know,
thank
it's
you.
Fascinating because there were two things, kibbutz and moshav, which were a little different. The kibbutz, everything was owned communally, and the moshav, there was some private property.
Yeah.
And it sounds like really among the kibbutzim that are still around, they've become, if anything, more like moshavim and maybe even not quite that.
Yeah. Even less.
Even less.
Yeah.
Just sort of less. A place where there's some additional communal ties.
Mm-hmm.
I should note that there are kibbutzim who have actually become big businesses. You know, there are some that have very successful hotels. There's some that have high-tech centers.
Yeah. There is some of the kibbutzim that they give up the ideology like early and understand that in order to success and flourish, they will need to find like some
source
like
income.
A business. Yeah. It was a business. And you know, some of them, and I won't mention names of the kibbutzim, but some of them that very successful, like won't accept even their kids as a new member for the kibbutz in order that they will have few where to divide, you know,
to divide the pot.
Yeah. Yeah.
So sort of the opposite of the kibbutz mentality.
But I really want to end like an optimistic statement.
Sure.
Some of the kibbutzim that went bankruptcy in the past actually succeed to do something new, like Kibbutz Sasa at the north. Like after they went bankruptcy, they started from the beginning. They have right now a very successful factory that works with the government of Israel. So there is a, I don't know what the future will bring.
But a very important part of Israel's past. Thanks, Oshrat. We'll talk next weekend. Again, Chag Sameach.
Thank you.
When we come back on To Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. The state of Arizona allows its taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations, who then provide scholarships for kids from kindergarten through 12th grade to attend qualified private schools. JETCO helps provide a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get a 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Tax credit's not a deduction. Your taxes are reduced by the amount you give. Join over 750 supporters last year who donated money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. There's an additional tax credit now, the switcher credit, which increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,031 for single filers, $2,062 for married couples filing jointly. When we are fighting every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, we should all take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to help foster a Jewish identity for our community's children. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive the financial aid they need to receive a good Jewish education. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, call 520-647-8442, again 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of education.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And almost happy Hanukkah.
Right.
You came back recently from a trip to Morocco. You've been sharing some great Moroccan tales of that ancient and interesting Jewish community. Most Moroccan Jews, of course, now living in Israel, in France, in America, in Canada, but still an interesting community today.
Right. So, one thing that I should share with your listeners is that although Morocco and Israel don't have official diplomatic relations and there are no direct flights between the two countries, there are huge amounts of commercial and personal exchanges in the sense that one of the largest sources of tourism in Morocco is Israelis, both of Moroccan origin and not of Moroccan origin, who visit Morocco in large tour groups, so that a fair number of Moroccan tour guides have taught themselves Hebrew. They didn't grow up in Hebrew school. They're not Jewish. But they deal directly with Israelis so frequently that it has paid them to learn Hebrew. Would that American Jews were as fluent in Hebrew as Moroccan Muslim tour guides. But the other thing that's interesting about Morocco is that, you know, the Arabs only arrived in Morocco in the end of the 8th century. They're newcomers. The Berbers were there before, and long before the Arabs were there, Romans were there. And not every place in the country, but fairly far in the interior. There's a big site called Volubilis in the middle of the country, not on the coast, not on the Mediterranean. And throughout the Roman world, as you and many of your listeners know, there were Jewish populations in every Roman port, in every Roman city. So that included Morocco. And the Jewish community of Morocco goes back at least to Roman times, if not earlier. But the one thing we saw very dramatically on this visit was that in Berber villages, even in the high Atlas Mountains, in relatively small places, there were Jewish communities. And the Jews monopolized certain crafts like silversmithing and the making of jewelry and a few other things, which apparently nobody else could do. You could only buy those things from Jews. And in one fairly small town, Berber, not village, but city called Sefru, we visited a complex which had been established as an orphanage for Jewish children who had no parents. And there were dorms and classrooms and a synagogue in the middle of this orphanage. And the place is well maintained. There are no Jews living in Sefru anymore. There's no Jewish community there. But Jews outside the country, again, mostly of Moroccan origin, but not necessarily, collected money to maintain this place. And it's active. There are other kids living there now. But the synagogue is untouched and respected. And there are still some books there. And it was quite an interesting visit for our group to see that in a fairly remote place in the interior, where the Berber population greatly outnumbers the Arab population, there was clear, tangible evidence of an important enough Jewish community and a sizable enough Jewish community that they built this big orphanage with classrooms and a synagogue and all that. And clearly, at one point, it was not the only synagogue in town. It's the only one that's still preserved and visitable, but it just sort of completes a picture of what was once a thriving, very diverse, spread throughout the country type of Jewish community.
You know, a fascinating Jewish community with a tremendous history and great scholarship. Maimonides, of course, lived there for a long time.
Not to mention great food.
And great food, too. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
Look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. As the El Al plane settled down at Ben-Gurion Airport in Israel, the voice of the captain came on. Please remain seated with your seatbelt fastened until the plane is at a complete standstill and the seatbelt signs have been turned off. To those of you standing in the aisles, struggling to pull Hanukkah presents that you bought overseas out of the overhead compartments, we wish you a happy Hanukkah. To those of you who have remained politely seated in your seats, we wish you a Merry Christmas. Yes, that was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and remain seated. And now a word of Torah. In this week's Torah portion of Miketz, we are in the midst of the fabulous story of Joseph, now shorn of his technicolor dream coat and locked away in an Egyptian prison. Dreams play a central role, not for the first time in Genesis and not for the first time in the Joseph story. In Miketz, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, dreams a famous dream. Seven fat cows emerge from the Nile River and are eaten then by seven skinny cows. Then seven fat ears of grain are devoured by seven lean ears of grain. The Pharaoh wakes up puzzled and disturbed. What does it all mean?
None of the Egyptian king's brilliant advisors, counselors, and magicians can help him. In desperation, he turns to a forgotten Hebrew prisoner who once helped his chief wine steward, that is his bartender, when he was in jail with him. It is Joseph, the Hebrew slave, long forgotten. And so Joseph is dragged from prison, cleaned up, redressed, and brought to the Pharaoh, perhaps the most powerful man in the world at the time. Joseph hears Pharaoh's dreams and correctly interprets them as prophesying 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. Giving full credit to God for being his only source of this insight, Joseph helps the Pharaoh to save Egypt, and things go well both for him and Egypt. Joseph rises to great prominence, second in command of the country, and the Pharaoh's power is multiplied, while the Egyptian people are saved from starvation. The story doesn't end there, of course. Joseph marries, has two children, but oddly, his great success, his power and fame throughout Egypt, and his new family aren't quite enough for Joseph. He misses his father, left behind in Canaan, and pines for his younger brother Benjamin, the only living reminder of his dead mother, Rachel. He never expects to see his father and full brother again. He is, in a word, depressed. But then, in a plot twist worthy of the finest novelist, his brothers are compelled by famine to come down to Egypt to buy bread. Suddenly, the same characters who beat him and sold him into slavery are completely in his power. What an amazing opportunity for revenge. And in this week's portion of Miketz, Joseph seems to take advantage of that. He teases and torments his brothers. He is fully aware of their identity, they completely ignorant of his. It's a game of cat and mouse, and Joseph seems to relish manipulating, teasing, even emotionally torturing his brothers. What will happen? As the Torah portion of Miketz concludes, we are left wondering just which way it will go. Next week, we'll get the answer, but this week, the issue is clearly delineated. How exactly will an assimilated Jew respond to pressure to continue to hide his identity? Just as the Jews in the days of the Maccabees struggled with tremendous pressure to accept cultural subjugation and give up Judaism, so Joseph struggled with hiding his Hebrew identity or admitting it in public. No matter how prominent we become, the pressure to assimilate, even sometimes hide our Jewish identity, can be overwhelming. In a season in which the majority culture can overwhelm us with songs, foods, and religious trappings, we Jews today sometimes struggle to assert our own pride in our Jewish identities. May we learn from the lessons of Joseph and the Maccabees that Jewish identity is to be asserted proudly and with commitment always, even in the shortest of days. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Gershom Sizomu of the Abu Yudaya people, will explain just how he became the chief rabbi of Uganda and what it was like as a Ugandan Jew to live through Idi Amin and the famous Israeli rescue of the hostages of Entebbe. Find out when we return on To Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The nuclear disarmament talks between Iran and the West, begun so promisingly a few weeks ago, received a preview of what is likely in store from a Gullible World Media last week. Photos were suddenly released of what was undoubtedly a spontaneous and patriotic protest by an absolutely free and uncoerced group of Iranian Jews in Tehran in support of Iran's nuclear program. This choreographed demonstration came a day before the resumption in Geneva of negotiations between Iran and world powers over Iran's rabid nuclear weapons program. The demonstration by Iranian Jews was held in front of the United Nations office in Tehran. The demonstrators held Torah scrolls and signs in English, Hebrew, and Farsi. The demonstrators denounced Zionism and threw their support behind the country's nuclear talks negotiating team. The Iranian Islamic secret policemen holding the protesters' loved ones at gunpoint were not visible in the photo taken of the event, unfortunately. Also in advance of the meetings, Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei announced in broadcast remarks that his country wants friendly ties with the world community, including the United States, but that Israel is, quote, doomed to extinction, unquote. Khamenei also said that France, which has taken a hardline stance during the negotiations, is not only succumbing to the United States, but they are kneeling before the Israeli regime. Israel objects to the current deal reported to be on the table, under which crippling sanctions on Iran will be eased if it only stops enriching uranium to more than a minimum percentage. While we would like to be hopeful about the peaceful resolution of this awful problem, we are not seeing such good signs coming out of Tehran right now, whether in Hebrew, English, or Farsi. Last week also marked the first anniversary of Operation Pillar of Defense, Israel's 8-day assault on Gaza, with the aim of ending rocket fire on Israeli towns in the south. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu marked the occasion by visiting the desert headquarters of the IDF's Gaza division and giving a speech to the troops. The operation reduced rocket and mortar fire by 98%. There is no doubt, Netanyahu said, that significant deterrence has been achieved. A total of over 1,000 rockets and mortar shells had been fired at Israel from Gaza by Hamas and other Islamist terrorist groups in the 10.5 months preceding the Israeli attack last year, that is, from January 1st through November 13th, 2012. Israel's deterrent was in kind. 8 days of heavy bombardment, hitting some 1,500 sites, ranging from ammunition dumps and rocket launchers to government offices and apartment buildings. An estimated 175 Palestinians died. The cost to Israel was 6 dead, including 4 civilians killed by Hamas rocket fire. The result, a full year afterward, from November 2012 to November 2013, Israel was targeted from Gaza by a grand total of 35 rockets. That's 35 too many, but that's down 1,000 from the previous year. For all practical purposes, Israel has more or less eliminated the Gaza rocket problem. Hamas not only stopped firing rockets themselves, it aggressively sent its police after the jihadi radical terrorists who wanted to keep up the barrage. Life in Israel's southern towns and communities has returned to normal, at least for now. So, how did Israel do it? According to some commentators, it was by using both the stick and the carrot. They punished Hamas in such a way that it made the price of attacking Israel too high even to consider, what we call deterrence. But Israel also offered an olive branch with practical implications. Under the November 2012 Egyptian-brokered ceasefire that ended the attacks, Israel agreed to a significant easing of the economic blockade of Gaza. The number of trucks allowed to enter Gaza was increased, the crossing's hours of operations were extended, regular building materials were allowed in, and so on. Hamas complied mostly by controlling its own terrorist impulses. We can only continue to hope that this nearly year-long peace in the South will remain the case for years to come. And in news that causes pride and a very weird feeling, Adam Levine, the lead singer of the band Maroon 5, was officially named People Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive. In the 28 years of the award, Levine is the first Jewish guy so named. The Jewish frontman for the popular rock band was surprised by the news.
The singer said, as a musician, you have fantasies. You want to win Grammys. But I didn't really think this was on the table. I was just amazed and stunned, and it almost seemed like they were kidding, but they weren't, so that's cool. The Maroon 5 frontman and the voice coach also revealed that he keeps his abs of steel strong with yoga and spinning. Adam Levine is engaged to a Victoria's Secret model. I didn't think marriage for me was going to be in the cards for a long time, the 34-year-old said. I was ready when I was ready. That's about as simple as it could possibly be. In any case, past winners, besides Adam Levine, of the Sexiest Man Alive include Brad Pitt, George Clooney, and Channing Tatum, none of them Jewish.
Tap on my window, knock on my door, I want to make you feel beautiful.
And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World.
We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Rabbi Gershom Sizomu. He's the chief rabbi of Uganda, leader of the Abu Yudaya Jews, of one of the, I don't want to say most isolated, but it is most isolated and unique Jewish communities, not only in the world, but in all of history. He is the first black rabbi from sub-Saharan Africa to be ordained at an American yeshiva, at an American rabbinical school, American seminary. And his own journey is a very interesting one. Tell us how it was that you decided to become a rabbi.
Actually, I decided very early in my time. I decided in 1979 when Amin was defeated on Pesach.
Yeah.
And I thought this was very impressive.
If Idi Amin can be defeated on Pesach, it must be God's mission.
Exactly. And so in 1983 on my Bar Mitzvah, I announced that I would become the next leader of my people.
At the age of 13 years?
Age of 13 years old.
And that's an adult.
Exactly. And I worked towards that. I studied on my own. I became knowledgeable in the Hebrew language. I led services. I taught other people the Hebrew language. And I participated in giving devout Torahs even at an early age. And that made me become a rabbi for my young...
For your community.
My generation.
For your generation.
And so in 2003... I was accepted at the Ziegler School of Rabbinic Studies in Los Angeles.
The Conservative Seminary.
Conservative Seminary. After...
Now it's American Jewish.
It used to be
University of Judaism.
Exactly. Right. So I was at a conference in San Francisco. It was organized by an organization called Bechol Lashon.
Mm-hmm. In all languages.
In all languages. So the director of Bechol Lashon asked how he could be helpful to me and to my community. I told him I wanted to have formal rabbinic training so that I can provide rabbinic knowledge and leadership to my community. He actually called the Ziegler School, and what followed were a series of interviews and placement examinations, and I was accepted. I studied there for 5 years, 4 in the United States, 1 in Israel, and I was ordained in 2008.
Well, that's a tremendous story. So I have to ask a weird question. In 1976, when I was 15 years old, I spent a summer in Israel, and a plane was hijacked to Uganda and was freed in part by Yoni Netanyahu, may rest in peace, the brother of the current Israeli Prime Minister, and the famous raid on Entebbe. What was it as an experience for a Ugandan Jew?
Actually,
in
that very good question. In Uganda, outlawed Judaism, and so there was no active Jewish religious life in Uganda.
So religious life, no, even though Judaism had been there since 1919.
Uh-huh. So during the entire
against
period,
the law.
Against the law. No kippot, no funerals, no service, no life cycle events. And what happened is that when our community knew about the hostages in Entebbe, a secret fast was declared. And people fasted under the cover of their houses and prayed in their bedrooms. When Amin was humiliated by a small force of the Israeli army, it was a relief. It was inside joy within the community. We celebrated.
How many children do you have in your schools? How many Jewish children do you have in your schools in Uganda now?
We have about 200 kids in our primary school,
mm-hmm.
and about 70 kids.
70 kids to or so
100
in
high school.
Do children go on to college? What percentage of the children do you think will get a higher education?
Yeah, we
speaking as a Jew who always talks about learning.
Exactly.
You know,
like, yeah, right. We have had about in the past, let me say, 20 years,
mm-hmm.
we have had about 50 people go to college.
That's terrific.
Yeah, which is good for our community.
Big accomplishment in your community.
Exactly.
So it must have been very strange to be the only African studying in a rabbinical seminary in America.
Yes, yes. At first, everybody there thought it was a joke, but then it became serious. And I learned, I had the passion, and I was willing to go through a rabbinic school, although difficult. It was difficult.
Must have been.
And fortunately, my colleagues, my fellow students, my classmates, welcomed me with open heart and hands. And I was basically a star in the whole school environment for being the only Ugandan African in a rabbinic school. Actually, even at school, the whole school.
In the whole school, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, not just the not education, just undergraduate, and
yes,
everything.
Yes.
How do you say mazel tov in Ugandan? I've always wanted to know, and I don't.
Yes, we actually say mazel tov, okay, in Hebrew. We don't have a Uganda.
There's no Ugandan correlate.
Mazel tov.
That's okay. There's really no way to say it in English.
Yeah.
Either. It's mazel tov.
Yes.
Do you hope that some of your students also become rabbis?
Yes, yes. And many of them are moving towards that. They are committed and dedicated to community service. And I think that if we get the funding, that they will jump on the plane right away and come to rabbinic school.
It's an expensive proposition, this rabbinical school thing.
Exactly.
When a Ugandan comes for bar mitzvah, are there any special rituals, or is it sort of something similar to what you would find anywhere around the world? Are there any special rituals around weddings that are unique to Ugandan Jews?
Not very much. But bar mitzvahs are recent because they are not in the Bible.
Right.
Being a biblical community,
right,
everything that they observed was extracted directly from the Bible.
So did they also observe like Hanukkah, which is not biblical?
Which is recent also.
Right.
Yeah, now they do.
Only 2,200 years, but recent for anybody who is following the Tanakh.
Exactly. Right. So we are doing everything. We do weddings, and for our chuppah, we hold our chuppah with sugar cane.
With?
Sugar canes.
With sugar cane.
Uh-huh. And then after the ceremony, uh-huh, the sugar canes
is cut up and then served. And everybody eats the sugar
exactly
cane. So it's a sweet marriage.
Exactly.
I love that. It's a wonderful, wonderful ritual. Maybe we'll try that in America.
Yes. So
it would work in Louisiana. They've got plenty of sugar cane there.
Great.
I want to thank Rabbi Gershon Szizomu for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about the Jewish community of Uganda?
There is a website here operated by the organization that has helped us sustain our community, Bechol Lashon.
Bechol Lashon, and that's what? Becholashon.
Exactly, exactly.
Thank you so much, and best of continued best of luck.
Thank you so much.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out from the
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Lauren Sklamberg of the fabulous musical group The Klezmatics, who are going to be at the Fox Theater here in Tucson on December 5th. Get your tickets soon.
Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Hanukkah preview of music for the Great Festival of Lights, which begins this Wednesday night, November 26th, the night before Thanksgiving. Just 3.5 more shopping days until Hanukkah starts. It's from the Klasmatics, and it's from their Hanukkah album of Woody Guthrie songs called Happy Joyous Hanukkah. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, an excellent Thanksgiving holiday, a Chag Chanukah Sameach, a wonderful beginning to Hanukkah, and a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
How many nights for Hanukkah? Happy, joyous Hanukkah. Nights and days, days and nights. Happy, joyous Hanukkah. Hey to the nights of Hanukkah. Happy, joyous Hanukkah. Hey to the days and hey to the nights. Happy, joyous Hanukkah. How many candles do I light? Happy, joyous Hanukkah. Eight are the candles you should